And we're back. It's Taylor Report, CIAT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And we are joined now by Mr. Rick Rozoff, who is the impresario of Stop NATO. And it's a wonderful site. And we have a crisis unfolding in Ukraine, but also others in the same region we need to know about. Are you there, Rick?
I sure am, Phil. Thanks for having me back.
It's always nice to talk to you, and it couldn't be more timely because we have this phenomena that has gone on since, I guess we could say, November of 2013. It seems to still be percolating. And could you just remind us, it's supposedly an immense thing, that a kind of world-stopping event, that the government of Ukraine made a decision perhaps tentative, that they would not go forward with a project with the EU. Could you outline what that was about? And is it true that that was an exclusive kind of arrangement that they were being invited into?
It wasn't exclusive. It's part of a broader program called the Eastern Partnership, which was launched by the European Union, incidentally, with not only the full support, but I would hazard to guess at the instigation of the United States. You know, the European Union is not so exclusively European, we should recall, and that the U.S. uses it frequently as both a carrot and stick to whip into line recalcitrant voting populaces throughout Europe, particularly in the East and the South. But what happened in 6 years ago is using Poland, which at that time was a new NATO member as well as a new EU member, they got into NATO first, which is a precondition, essentially, for joining the European Union. I hope your listeners are aware of that. That with the exception of Cyprus and Malta, I don't know of any of the newer EU countries that entered the EU without first entering as full NATO members. So what happened is with Poland and Sweden, which is a founding member of the European Union, and although not technically, and I underline that, a NATO member, has signed its own association agreement, if you will, with NATO, and supplied 500 soldiers for the war in Afghanistan and Gripen warplanes for the war against Libya, and is now going to join NATO's essentially global strike force, the NATO response force. So those two countries launched the initiative called Eastern Partnership, a very insidious program, I might add, and one that I really wish people had taken more note of 6 years ago when it surfaced. What it does is targets all but these Central Asian former Soviet republics outside of Russia for economic and ultimately political and military integration into the West, those six republics being Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia, you know, those countries in Eastern Europe and in the Caucasus. The five former Soviet Central Asian republics are targeted by a comparable or analogous EU initiative, incidentally, not to, you know, to leave them out of the picture, which effectively is designed to wean those countries away from the Commonwealth of Independent States, you know, the post-Soviet formation. Mm-hmm. Which is largely economic in basis, and also in the case of Ukraine, to sabotage the newly emerging, former Eurasic, current custom union project that Russia is cultivating with Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. So, in both instances, undermining those two organizations is meant to effectively isolate Russia within former Soviet space, mm-hmm. so that it loses. I don't want to say even predominant, but perhaps ultimately any sort of economic arrangements with its neighbors to the east and the south. That's mm-hmm. the intent of the Eastern Partnership. Mm-hmm. On November 21st, Ukraine tentatively demurred, and your phraseology is correct, Phil. It didn't reject. It simply postponed signing an association agreement with the European Union under the auspices of the Eastern Partnership. But that alone was the trigger for the series of initially protest, what is ultimately a violent uprising against the government. And nobody can convince me. I've been in the Ukraine. I visited there. And I can't believe that the sentiments are so passionate for European Union affiliation that they would burn down the capital and plunge the country into civil war. So that I have to assume, as I think you were intimating, that this is more pretext than reason. You know, incidentally, before I forget, a poll was done by a fairly reputable polling agency in the Ukraine last week that asked people, you know, whether they feared a civil war in the country. 38% said they felt indeed there would be a civil war. 31% strongly felt so that almost 70%, 69% of Ukrainians in that poll feared a civil war in the country, and I believe that is the scenario that's been cooked up in the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you there. That could be because they've been listening and watching their leaders, the opposition leaders. Reporting here on what they say has been, carefully looked after in such a way you don't get the message. But I've gone to sites where I look at the words of Mr. Klitschko and Mr. Chernybach and others, and they talk about confrontation, and they say, we won't cooperate. I mean, this country will fall apart. I mean, the ordinary Ukrainian probably understands what they're saying.
Yeah, let injustice be done, though the heavens fall, to rework the Latin expression. But, you know, what we're dealing with in this case, as in so many of the color revolutions, so I think it's important to note this is a phase beyond, you know, the first wave of color revolutions, including the so-called Orange Revolution, originally Chestnut Revolution, I believe, until they came, hit on the right title, of almost a decade ago. This is something qualitatively more advanced and more dangerous in that it's a well-organized violent attempt. I'm not saying the entirety of it was or even is violent in nature, but you mentioned, you know, the head of the Svoboda Party, which is a, you know, known to be, you know, fascist leaning even pro-Nazi party. The Taganabuk, you mentioned, who's part of the triumvirate that is being supported by the West. I mean, they regularly meet with, as recently as 4 days ago, they met with none other than Victoria Nuland, and I know we're both champing at the bit to talk about her,
yes.
The Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, and on the same day met with the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, which is the Baroness, Catherine Ashton. That is her title.
I'm glad you mentioned I thought I was going to be helping out with that detail. Yes, the Baroness.
Yeah, I'm sorry to beat you to the punch.
Yeah, they like to call her Kate and probably make her
the people's Baroness.
Make her more, yes, more plebeian. Yes, and on the matter of the, there are people there with clear names. There's the Ukrainian National Assembly, hyphen, Ukrainian National Self-Defense Organization. And I'll ask you about this photograph. Here in our papers, the Toronto Star ran a picture, and it said mourners. And they show the gentleman carrying a coffin of a man killed by the terrible security forces of Ukraine. And that's the gist of the story. But on the shoulder, they're all wearing military camouflage dungarees and masks. And on their shoulder, they have a patch of the defense organization, self-defense group. But our paper failed to tell us who they were. And the body was draped with their flag. These are fighters, by the way. They don't pull punches. In a Time magazine profiled their leader. And he said there would be a revolution if they don't get their way.
I
think he also said they have arms. They already have an arsenal.
A key leader to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, Glisaev, if I'm not mistaken, last week, you know, mentioned that he estimates the U.S. is funneling $20 million a week into the Ukrainian opposition, including for arms. And this is not somebody speculating on an obscure website. This is somebody who has the ear of the Russian head of state. And I think that's probably a fair assumption. You know, we have to keep in mind, to flash back what will soon be 10 years ago, the winter of 2004-2005 with the original Orange Revolution, where on U.S. prompting, as much as with the Victorian Nuland Jeffrey Pyatt conversation we'll have occasion to talk about shortly, I'm sure, that the U.S. Set up a triumvirate at that point. And it wasn't just the Yatsenyuk, Klitschko, and Tiyanovuk, but at that time it was Viktor Yushchenko, Yulia Tymoshenko, and Alexander Meraz, the third being the head of the Socialist Party of Ukraine at that time. And this was a typical technique that began the genesis of the color revolution technique, although really pioneered in Yugoslavia, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in the autumn of 2000, officially became a color revolution, if you will, in 2003 in Georgia, where, again, there was the triumvirate model that subsequently was used in Ukraine in 2004, the following year in Kyrgyzstan, and again now in Ukraine. That seems to be the preferred method of the U.S. State Department and other agencies and organizations. Mm-hmm. So that, but now we have it pushed, appreciably beyond. The three people I mentioned of a decade ago, two had been prime ministers under the Leonid Kuchma government, that is Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. Now you have the sort of gutter snipes you're describing, who could well be, compared to Kosovo Liberation Army type, fighters in 1999, or Free Syrian Army fighters, currently in Syria, and their analogs in Libya and other countries. These are. What conjures up more anything to me is the, beer hall push in Munich in, the early 1920s.
Yeah, they mention their veterans. I noticed that they kind of use that. And of course, that, by the way, the origins of the National Socialist Party were that they all called themselves, veterans who had been stabbed in the back.
Right, and also many of them graduates of the Freikorps, that was set up by the nominally left Social Democratic Party out of veterans, disillusioned or disaffected veterans who are always a very volatile and dangerous combination, particularly in a country that has lost the war now. Mm-hmm. And they're probably veterans of the Afghan War. Mm-hmm. I would guess, but we have to keep in mind that the Kuchma government had also deployed 2,000 troops to Iraq in the south central sector, for the most part, administered by Poland with assistance from NATO, and that even the current Yanukovych government has contributed a small cohort to NATO's international security assistance force in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So that they could be veterans of all these conflicts.
Yeah. We're speaking to Rick Razov, StopNATO.org, and we do have to talk about this moment. We have three leaders. They're called sometimes the Troika, or the other three really important leaders of the opposition. Then we were supposed to pay very close attention to them. One of them is tall and strong and a champion and et cetera. But they turn out to be Victoria's Secret.
That is wonderful. Thank you.
What are they?
Newland's new men. Victoria's Secret. What comes across in the telephone conversation we're talking about, which surfaced last Friday, and again, it is between the former spokesperson for the penultimate Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, Victoria Nuland, who is somebody worth watching. I mean, her political trajectory speaks volumes. I've had occasion, to compare her on a minor scale, of course, to the French diplomat Talleyrand. The state doesn't exist, only I do, though I believe is the quote from him, who was foreign minister.
There's a flavor of that in this, yes.
But she pops up in successive administrations, the Clinton administration, George W. Bush, and now, in several prominent roles in the State Department of the Obama administration. She was, for example, during the George W. Bush administration, U.S. ambassador to NATO. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of diplomat we're talking about. She's a wife, of course, of Robert Kagan.
Yes.
And she has made several visits to Ukraine since the crisis erupted on November 21st of last year, came back again last Thursday, as we were talking about. It was infamously known. I mean, if you want to talk about patronizing, condescending, and insulting behavior, handing out pastries to both demonstrators and security officers in one of her previous visits to Ukraine.
And she goes there a lot.
She knows where things are happening. Look, this is the epicenter of world politics right now. Let's not fool ourselves. Syria may be number two, but Ukraine is number one. Mm-hmm. That geostrategically, geopolitically, historically, this is a country that has a 1,400-some-odd kilometer border with Russia. It's a country of all the former Soviet republics, the one that is most intricately inextricably connected with Russia historically. There are people in western Ukraine around Lviv, who may feel otherwise, but I think history mm-hmm. does demonstrate yes. that.
You know, there is this issue, and I'm going to ask you about this. Of course, it just shows the romanticizing of the language, which is always dangerous. I saw this speech that you can also get on the web now, watch her talking to Ukrainian American Association. She says, we are, of course, in favor of the march, Ukrainian march to the West.
Yes.
And I don't know if they understand about land and all that, but you can't take it with you. I mean, you're actually going to have to stay where you yeah. are. It can't go. But that's to induce the idea that Ukraine is marching toward the West. It just seems to me so outrageous. And also, I used the wrong word there, Europe. Russia's in Europe. The last time I checked.
These are geopolitical, not geographical designations. It's not unusual over the last few years, for example, during the Mikhail Saakashvili regime in Georgia, where discussion was when Georgia joins NATO. And by the way, since the Bucharest summit of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 2008, the NATO, with the U.S., of course, being the prime mover in it, has repeatedly asserted that NATO and Georgia are to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as full members. It's not a question of if, but of when and under what conditions. Let's recall that. But it was not uncommon for Georgian politicians like Saakashvili, and they had their sentiments echoed in Brussels and Washington, incidentally, that when they join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the European Union, they will join Europe. They will enter Europe as though they were not in Europe beforehand. But yeah. in the case of Georgia, you're talking about a country that's primarily to the east of Turkey, which is not considered to be a European country, is it, primarily? But a country yes. to its east can join Europe by affiliating with the U.S.-dominated military.
Japan enjoys kind of honorary Western membership, right?
I suspect they were honorary Aryans under Hitler, weren't they?
That's exactly. There is this funny, curious thing. Incidentally, Hitler was in Europe. I'm glad you mentioned these things they want to go and join. Some rather nasty things happen there. Let's look at the conversation a bit, because it is, I found it, a treat. The way she talked about these gentlemen, now she said, Klitschko has been asked to join the government as prime minister. That's not a good idea. And so she said it's better that Yats, not his full name because you can't be bothered to say his whole name, and let's tell Yats that he can go in. She said two could stay out and they could still be the outsider, but he'd be on the inside. And she says he should be in touch with them four times a week.
It was that specific, you're correct.
We're talking about a destabilization game.
I mean, what we're talking about is it's so circumstantial and so precise that anyone who claims that this is simply, as the State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki and others have claimed, that this is, you know, par for the course, this is standard operating procedure, that's nonsense. She was giving orders to her underling, the U.S. ambassador who works for the State Department, of course, in Kiev, and telling him exactly who was in, who was out, what the ranking order would be of the new triumvirate. You're right, she referred to them condescendingly by these nicknames that for the world may as well be Larry, Curly, and Moe.
Yes.
The State Department's three morons and proxies, and they don't even rise to the level of a Quisling.
No, now we've got to point that out. You have discussed this in other sites. By the way, please follow Rick Rozoff. He's being interviewed all over the place, and we're glad to be talking to him. But this thing about who should be apologized to, she made a kind of a mumbling apology to the EU. But how about to your three the Goebbels don't even answer. They don't even say, hey, don't talk about me that way. At all. Klitschko hasn't even issued a statement.
When somebody betrays their own nation for personal political advancement out of a sense of umbrage or something, you know, a Coriolanus or an Alcibiades or somebody in history, for people who know their Plutarch, there's at least a sense in which the person who buys and uses them has to maintain their dignity. Mm-hmm. And they themselves, the traitors attempt to maintain their dignity. You know, after this, if Klitschko in particular continues to have any dealings with his American handlers, Yeah, he has proven himself by that very fact to be absolutely without shame. That's number one. But let's go beyond that. You know, the fact that this very same Victoria Nuland, who, as you mentioned in the speech you allude to, which was last December at the U.S.-Ukraine conference or center or something. By the way, there's a huge Chevron logo to her
left. I noticed that. I thought, what country is that? Oh, that's Chevron.
Which, you know, speaks volumes, does it not? But that when, you know, she talks about working hand in glove with the same Baroness Ashton, whose organization, the European Union, she refers to
yeah,
as...
F them,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, right. Nevertheless, I mean, that's, you know, presumably narcissism of minor differences, I think, as Sigmund Freud described it. They are so on the same script that if they vary ever so little, as a matter of fact, there's a one, well, that's another issue, but they are so, the working hand in glove, they both showed up in Kiev at the same time, again, last Thursday, both met with the Troika or the Triumvirate or the three whatevers. In the same day. I mean, they're clearly working in unison with each other. So that her comment, and this is how the even pseudo-alternative media in the world is presenting us. You know, they're rubbing their hands and licking their chops because this is some reason to, you know, accentuate a split between the U.S. and the European Union. Nothing could be further from the truth. The real apology ought to be rendered to both the government and the people of Ukraine.
Yes, and incidentally, the way you make an apology credible is you resign, because you say, well, we don't want any of our representatives to speak that way. Obviously, this person has failed us because they conveyed the wrong message. It's a serious message she's conveying, and it indicates contempt for a state, of course, but also leading political figures who've been chosen by their people to hold office, and then you talk like that. If it's not your policy, the government of Ukraine could say, what are you going to do with this representative of yours?
That's a very good point. And I'm as surprised as I believe you are that there is so little reaction from official circles, both in Kiev and in Moscow, by the way, because she was pointedly clear that the EU was a little bit tardy or sluggish in moving for a coup d'etat in Kiev, and as a result might give Russia time to maneuver. Isn't that terrible? Russia might maneuver in its neighboring country, whereas the U.S. reserves the exclusive right, of course, to dictate who is or is not.
Who'll be in a government and who'll be out.
That's it.
And to reserve to put one guy in while they shake the boat to make the other guy fall out. I mean, it's to watch. She says the other two can stay out. Incidentally, she's very comfortable, I noticed, with Mr. Janibach. Now,
yes.
Meanwhile, they're selling themselves as, oh, we don't like people who attack gays and we don't like people who attack the Jewish minorities in East Europe. And I have to say that Mr. Westerveld of the German government, he wouldn't meet with Janibach. But she says, oh, Janibach could stay on the outside and with his people. And you're running that.
Yeah, Janibach's flag, you know, his party flag until 2008 was, I invite people to go on Google or something, look it up, is a transparent variation of the swastika.
Yes.
So there's no question about who they're dealing with here. And, you know, this is quite in keeping with...
Yeah, and by the way, they could do this on the up and up if they believed it. That would be to say, well, of course, Mr. Janibach can't come to this meeting. We're not going to be entertaining that.
Mm-hmm.
But they just expect us all to look the other way. And incidentally, a lot of people around the world are going to, unfortunately for them, ask very persistently, how far are we going to go down the road with this guy?
No, I'm quite sure you're right. But, you know, it's evocative of similar policies in Croatia, Latvia, Estonia, where the West has embraced, you know, open Nazi collaborators, the SS veterans, say, in the Baltic states.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been no impediment to joining not only the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in the case of all three nations I just mentioned, but the European Union in all three cases.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, apropos of this identification of the guy who seems to be there, the front runner, Mr. Klitschko, who he reminds me of. I know you've had some Rocky Balboa comments and Mr. Stallone and others, but when I look at him, I'm seeing Primo Canera, who is a big mediocrity just like him.
Or Horst Wessel, perhaps.
Yeah. Now, he fought out of Berlin. His career was in Germany. His career was not in Ukraine.
That's correct.
He was all his handlers and everybody. And he... has, we're told, around him advisors and assistants provided out of the party and office of Merkel.
So I wasn't aware of that.
That struck me that maybe this would be another reason the U.S. might prefer him, you know, not to be the guy who, you know, to put him on another position. I'm sure he's just an opportunist. Did you notice the language where the guy said, well, we have family problems? Well, I'd love to hear about that. That'd be Mr. the differences between Johnny Bark, Yats, and Klitschko, the pretender. But there's no question that Merkel got embarrassed, and she did say, hey, I don't appreciate it. But then you have this further backdrop that the State Department says, oh, the Russians have sunk to a new low. Look at that. They recorded one of our conversations. I recall that Merkel, one of her last big show things was with Obama saying, you are tapping my personal phone. Would you please stop? And he said he'd look into that.
Yeah, good of you to remember that. I had forgotten that. That's true. So in terms of lows, but, you know, keeping in mind that Psaki, the State Department spokesperson, repeatedly made statements to the effect, perhaps you're going to recall it more accurately than I can, that we have no independent verification, the Russians did. In other words, we have no proof.
Yes, exactly.
So you go into a court of law and you press charges against someone, and when asked what you base those charges on, you say, well, it just happened. We have no independent verification.
Your Honor, he's a Russian.
That's it.
case closed. Last question here. I want to ask you, this is the part that I think I wish people would think a lot about. My understanding is that Mr. Putin has said, and all Russian governments have previously on this matter said, well, we'd be happy to enter into an agreement where we all trade. Why does this have to be exclude us? Can you talk about that?
It's certainly not the Russian intent to I'm sure they would prefer people not join the European Union. Let's be, you know, in former Soviet space, let's be clear about that. But I don't believe there's any stipulation within the projected customs union that precludes a membership in the European Union. There most assuredly is in the case of the European Union. Look, the Eastern Partnership is, again, an attempt to drive a stake through the heart of any kind of economic cooperation in the former Soviet space by weaning away from Russia the six European and South Caucasus, former Soviet republics, who, except for Georgia, which pulled out of it after the five-day war of 2008, are still members of the Commonwealth of Independent States. This is an effort to destroy the Commonwealth of Independent States. And the fact that Russia and the Yanukovych government, you know, balked at that proposition, because that's what it means. There's an upcoming conference in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, to solidify association agreements with those other countries, particularly with Moldova, which has now gone into the U.S. camp with the so-called Twitter revolution of 5 years ago. But, you know, it's, you know, by the way, when we talk about the Klitschkos and company in Ukraine, you know, I can't help thinking of the comment by Zbigniew Brzezinski in his book of 1998, you know, The Grand Chessboard, where he says U.S. has allies, tributaries, and vassals.
Vassals.
And what we're talking about, the farther east and south you go, they move away from being tributaries to being simply vassals, slaves.
And that's what Victoria Nuland thought they were. Rick Raza, boy, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you more because obviously this story is going to get getting bigger. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. As the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, signing off.